Chapter 2. Mighty walls of pale stone had been defaced with 1,000 splashes of paint and blood, and the great marble statues that supported the coffered dome of the roof no longer depicted the first heroes of Unity and the Legion. Now they were bull-headed representations of the old lair gods, clandestine things whose heads were bowed or turned to the side as though keeping a delicious secret. Torn banners hung between fluted pilasters of green marble, the fabric shredded and scorched in the fires of the Legion's rebirth. The floor of the Heliopolis was fashioned from black terrazzo, with inlaid chips of marble and quartz intended to render it into a celestial bowl, reflecting the light from the great beam of lustrous starlight that shone down from the center of the dome. That light still shone, brighter and more piercing than ever before, and the floor's polish reflected it with dazzling intensity. Once, carved bench seats had run around the circumference of the council chamber, rising in stepped ranks towards the walls like the tiers of a gladiatorial arena. Those seats had now been demolished, for none would now sit higher than the Primarch of the Emperor's children, and portions of the rubble formed a plinth at the centre of the chamber, rugged and glistening like the graven idol of a primitive god. Upon this elevated platform sat a black throne of unrivaled magnificence, its surfaces mirror-smooth and reflective. The throne was all that remained of the previous incarnation of the Heliopolis, its regal majesty deemed suitably noble for the Primarch of the Emperor's children. Discordia blared from iron vox-casters, the screams of loyalists as they died on the black sand, the deafening cacophony of 100,000 guns, and the music of pleasure and pain intermingled. It was the sound of an empire's violent death, the sound of a pivotal moment in history that would replay over and over again, and of which the warriors forced to endure it would never tire. Perhaps 300 legionaries filled the chamber, and Lucius recognized many of them from the great battle on Istvan V. First Captain Caeseron, Marius Verusian, Dour Calimos of the 17th, Apothecary Fabius, Pouting Chrysander of the 9th, and a score of others to whom he had applied derogatory labels. Some were old faces of the Legion. Others were those who had attracted the fickle notice of the Primarch, while yet more were simply members of the Brotherhood of the Phoenix who had followed their betters. Like the Legion's ships and name, so too would the name of their quiet order stand. Lucius moved through the press of bodies towards Julius Caeseron, savouring the beautiful devastation of the first captain's features. An iron hand by the name of Santar had ruined Caeseron's face more thoroughly than Lucius could ever manage, and though Fabius had reconstructed much of his hairless skull, it was still a horror of vat-grown flesh stitched to fused bone, weeping orbs of milky blindness, and burned scar tissue the colour of weather-beaten copper. As wondrous as Julius Caeseron's blessed transformations were, they were subtle next to those wrought on Marius Verusian. Where the first captain had received his ruined visage at the hands of the enemy, Marius Verusian had been gifted during the rush of power unleashed by the Maraviglia. The captain's jaws were rigid and locked open with barbed cabling, as though he was forever screaming. His eyes were red and raw, bearing the savage scars of the wire-wound sutures, holding them open. Two great open wounds in the side of his head cut V-shaped gouges in his tapered skull, where his ears had once been located. Both captains wore armour that had been wondrously embellished with spikes and draped with leathered hides stripped from the bodies that littered the parquet of La Fenice. Yet for all their gaudy finery and obvious mutilations, Lucius saw Caeseron and Verusian as relics of the past. Officers of dogged loyalty who lacked the ambition or flair that would see a warrior burn brighter than a star. "Captains," said Lucius, layering just the right balance of respect and disdain into the syllables of their rank. It seems that war finally calls us.
Lucius,
said Verosian, giving him a nod of acknowledgement as his jaw cracked and its too wide circumference formed words that were swiftly becoming almost impossible to give voice. Such implied insolence from Lucius should have earned him a bloody reprimand, but his star was in the ascendancy. Eidolon, a warrior with an eye for spotting the way the wind was blowing, had seen it, and Verosian, ever the sycophant, knew it too. Caeseron was not so easily intimidated, and turned his cloudy eyes upon him. His expression was impossible to read, the ruin of his face making his true disposition a tantalizing mystery.
"Swordsman,"
hissed Caeseron through the raw wound of his mouth.
"You are a worm, and an ambitious worm at that."
"You flatter me, first captain," said Lucius, meeting his hostile gaze with one of supreme indifference. "I serve the Primarch to the best of my ability."
"You serve yourself and no one else,"
snapped Caeseron.
"I regret not leaving you on Istvan III with the rest of the imperfect ones. I think that I should kill you and be done with your flawed existence."
Lucius gripped the hilt of the lair sword and cocked his head to the side. "It would give me great pleasure to let you try, first captain," he said. Caeseron turned away, and Lucius grinned, knowing Caeseron would never openly follow through with his threat. Lucius would gut him in the opening moments of any duel, and the thought of murdering the first captain sent a thrill of pleasure through his body. "Any word on where we are?" he asked, knowing neither Caeseron nor Verosian would know, and keen to expose their ignorance to those around them. Verosian shook his head.
"That is for the Phoenician alone to know," he said,
the jagged notes of his voice like the braying discharge of his sonic cannon. "You have not been told," replied Lucius, with a smirk, as a line of hooded bearers carrying heavy iron casks on their backs snaked through the gaping portal of the vanished Phoenix Gate. To Lucius, they looked like ants bearing food to a hive. "I would have thought a warrior of your status would have been amongst the first to learn our destination. Have you earned the Primarch's ire?" Verosian ignored the obvious barb and gave a nod of acknowledgement as Eidolon took position near Caeseron, like the glory-seeker he was. The first captain had been one of Fulgrim's closest companions in the old days, and though the Phoenician appeared to care little for past attachments, Caeseron still commanded respect from most of the Legion. "Most, but not me," thought Lucius, with an amused smirk, as he saw the light of ambition in Eidolon's eyes. It was pathetic how the Lord Commander latched onto those the Primarch favoured, and Lucius felt his contempt for the man swell to new heights. "It looks like Fulgrim is breaking out the last of the victory wine," he said, with unearned bonhomie. "We only do that when we're about to go into battle."
"Old Legion custom,"
spat Verosian, his voice a wet, gurgling rasp. "We still drink to the victory to come," said Lucius, drawing his swords with a flourish and careful to let the warriors nearby see the silver blade Fulgrim had gifted to him. "By the will of Horus or the Phoenician, it matters not to the lords of profligacy. We still drink."
"We should not honour who we were before our ascension," said Eidolon.
"Not everything we were died on Istvan," replied Lucius, amused at the blatancy of the Lord Commander's ingratiating words. The casks of victory wine were deposited in a circle around the black throne in the column of blinding light. The smell was potent, bitter, and like engraver's acid. The gathered warriors leaned forwards as one to fully savour the acrid reek of the wine, fully aware of its symbolism. The blood surged in Lucius's veins at the thought of going into battle once more. The forced inaction of the journey from the Istvan system had chafed at him. He ached, needed to feel hot blood sprayed from an opened artery, the visceral thrill of meeting a bladesman who might prove his equal. He tried to remember the names of swordsmen of note in those legions still loyal to the Emperor, but could think of none who could match him. Sigismund of the Fists was a competent, if bluntly single-minded, wielder of the blade. And Nero of the 13th could kill with something approaching flair, though he fought with more than a hint of rote in his swings. Other names drifted through Lucius's memory, but as competent as they were, none of them had reached the sublime pinnacle of blade work that he had attained.
"Perhaps it will be Mars at last," he ventured. "We have travelled far enough. Perhaps we are making ready to join the fleets moving on the Red Planet, as Horus ordered."
"The War Master,"
said Eidolon, his taut skin wrinkling in childish adulation.
"He knows my name, and has commended me on several occasions."
Lucius knew better, but before he could contradict Eidolon's fantasy, a blare of noise erupted from the vox unit strung between the pilasters. A glorious scream of birth and murder shrieked in dissonant anti-harmonies, like a million orchestras with every instrument out of tune. The sound was rapturous, a freakish blend of discordant music and howling voices raised in hideous adoration. A cascade of light fell from the dome, a glittering rain that shimmered with a light so bright that it was like a moment of atomic detonation. The Emperor's children howled as sensory apparatus mutilated by Apothecary Fabius flooded their nervous systems with powerful surges of bioelectrical spikes, pleasure responses and pain signals. Warriors convulsed at the cacophony of sound and light, dancing like madmen or victims of grand mal seizures. Some tore at their skin, others beat their neighbours, while others pounded their fists bloody on the floor while screaming inchoate curses. Lucius held his body rigid, fighting the sensations and receiving the pleasure tenfold, his deliberate resistance to the overload of sensation making it all the sweeter. Blood and saliva ran from his lips, and he felt his bones and flesh vibrating in perfect symphony with the raucous madness of the spectacle. The legion screamed with the delirious joy of it, but this was merely a prelude. A shape moved in the light. An angel of extermination, a god made flesh and the embodiment of all that was perfect in its expression of intemperance. Fulgrim dropped through the lights like the brightest comet in the firmament, a hammer blow of Tyrian warplate the colour of a bruised sunset. He slammed down onto the terrazzo floor, a billowing mantle of fiery golden scales spread at his shoulders like a pair of angelic wings. Hair like a snowfall cascaded from his noble crown, and his slender aquiline features were tapered and elfin, though possessed of a haughty strength that none of the faded orphans of Asurion could hope to match. Fulgrim had eschewed his gaudy facial paints and scented oils, his face now pallid and ethereal, like a corpse wraith given form and clad in polished plate that gleamed with the sheen of the finest mirror. His eyes were black pits from which no light escaped or ever would, and his mouth creased in a smile that spoke of secret knowledge that would sear the mind of any but a Primarch were they to learn even a fraction of its scope. Lucius joined his fellow warriors in an orgiastic scream of welcome, a hymnal to excess, a chorus of pandemonium in praise of their liege lord. Just to be near the Phoenician fired the blood. Fulgrim stood and spread his arms to accept their devotion, tilting his head back as his full lips parted with the rapture of adoration. The discordia from the vox dropped in volume, and Fulgrim finally deigned to cast his gaze out amongst his warriors. The golden cloak draped across his shoulders, and the glitter of silver mail beneath his wondrously moulded breastplate shimmered like a waterfall of stars. A scabbard of ebony, mother of pearl and smoked ivory bands, hung from a belt of soft black leather, embossed with a buckle of amber and black. The anathema. Lucius knew this sword well, and even though it now belonged to the most sublime warrior imaginable, he could not resist the thought of what it might be like to face such a weapon. Sensing the scrutiny, Fulgrim turned his obsidian eyes upon Lucius and smiled as though in recognition of some shared bond known only to them. Lucius felt the power of that gaze and fought to keep his suspicions from showing on his face. He grinned back at Fulgrim and sliced the blades of his swords across the skin of his forehead. Blood dripped into his eyes, and he reveled in the bitter, rancid taste of it as it ran down the hundreds of grooves carved through the skin of his face to his waiting tongue.
"My children," said Fulgrim, as the glorious madness receded, "I bring you bliss."